Hello, I'm Pete Mitchell, celebrating the 30th anniversary of Fact 51, the Hacienda, Manchester. Friday nights with DJs Mike Pickering and Graham Park playing house were a guaranteed sellout, and by late 88 the club was becoming a worldwide phenomenon. Newsweek described it as the most famous club in the world. Nightclubbing was the new rock and roll.
Lunacy that we revelled in created a wonderful environment for us to have fun. It was like our own adult playground where we just indulged ourselves.
A friend from Germany who came over and he actually loved Manchester so much that he came to live and got a job in Manchester. But he was a bit of a dope, this guy, innit? I said, well, what made you pick Manchester? He said, I came over here as a student, and I went to the Hacienda and everyone was really friendly, everyone was smiling, and they didn't drink alcohol, they just had an orange juice, or everyone was really, really friendly and smiling all the time. So I came to live over.
The vibe and the atmosphere around it, from the moment you approached it, it was like approaching Armageddon. You know, the noise, the people, the hysteria of people trying to get in. And, they did use that trick of where they keep the queue as long as possible, and you go in, there'd be nobody there. Why is there such a queue? You know, because it just looked great.
In July 1988, the first death through taking ecstasy occurred at the club. It made front page news. The dark clouds were beginning to gather.
And you know, you have to remember that in Manchester, that period from 89 to 93 was a very, very dangerous time. And the mixture of the drugs with the gangs, and the way that the police didn't fulfil their role, you'd have to say. They stood back and let us do it, you know, and we were just turkeys. If we hadn't have been so drunk, I honestly think we wouldn't have been able to get away with it.
In early 1989, Greater Manchester Police informed the club that they intended to apply to revoke the licence because of alleged drug abuse on the premises. It was part of an initiative by the police to curtail Manchester's growing drug and gang problem. The club was granted a six-month reprieve, but the writing was on the wall.
There was a constant battle with that, the chief constable, wasn't it? He was trying to shut everything down, so it was a constant battle with him. I mean, I remember on a New Year's Eve going to the Hass, and then afterwards there was always, you know, where's the party, where's the party? And there was always a rumour where it was, and there was a party in Ancoats, lovely place, in this old warehouse. I remember going to the party, and there was, you know, it was only like a couple of hundred people or something there, and there was a police cordon around the building with riot shield and a police helicopter flying overhead with searchlights. It's just New Year's Eve, for God's sake. You
do have to bear in mind that sometimes you were in fear for your life. They were all friends. They were all ticket touts that had grown into gangsters. You know, they were people that I'd grown up with in Salford. I mean, I was all right. Me and Bernard were the only ones that could mix. We could go in any alcove in the Hacienda. Anybody else that wandered in, they got a slap. They got a punch and beat up and thrown out.
Attendances began to tail off as adverse publicity gathered and a stricter door policy was enforced. But problems persisted as the drug gangs battled to control the door of the club.
I think we were one of the only clubs in Britain that didn't sell our own drugs. All the other clubs, and they can sue me if they want, used to sell their own drugs. They used to have their own drug dealers in the premises. And Rob, again, wouldn't do it because he felt it was immoral. You know, no chance, no way are we doing that. You know, you've got a better job than that. This is just fun. Don't dilute the fun.
After a doorman was threatened with a gun, the club voluntarily closed its doors. Tony Wilson told the press that he was sick and tired of instances of personal violence and could not allow the club to remain open if he could not ensure that the personal safety of his staff and customers was guaranteed. It reopened some months later, but things soon turned nasty. One Friday evening, six doormen were stabbed. Police turned up with riot shields and CS gas, and roadblocks were set up as 1,200 clubbers were forced to stay on until 5 a.m.
I remember it very well. One of the Salford lot came through the front door, and one of the doormen under his breath called him a Salford dickhead, and he phoned up for reinforcements. They all came in and stabbed them all up the arse, and the police had to come and shut down the club, and everyone got locked in by the riot squad, and they started letting them out and photographing them all and all that crap. It was just ridiculous. But I mean, you were part of a runaway snowball that was going downhill, and it was very exhilarating while it was going, but it was ultimately dangerous. And you know, that is something that you do have to bear in mind. And Tony valiantly tried to change the police attitude to their way of policing clubs, and a lot of the things that they do now were things that Paul Mason, the manager of the club, and Tony and Rob were trying to persuade him to do, you know, in 1988. They just left us to it, mate. And these people, you could not control. You couldn't police it, basically. The towards the end of 90, I think, basically the violence, the club, the gangsters were running the club, and you couldn't, you just couldn't stop them. They were chasing the bouncers out.
No one could have predicted the intense social pressure Manchester's clubland was under. The dream was turning into a nightmare. Noel Gallagher.
What became known as Manchester had turned into guns and drugs and the gang thing in Manchester, in the Hacienda and all that. The dream had died. It was gloomy, but there was nothing. When I was 22 at the time, and when you're writing songs for an audience that are also 22 years of age, and you're all in the same circumstances, and you all shop in the same shops and drink in the same pubs, that's magical. You cannot buy that.
Hacienda DJ Dave Haslam.
It was like an ending of that culture. It was like everything that we'd built up. You know, the drugs were around, the rave vibe was around. It was an ending, because from that moment, the summer of 1990, that coincides more or less with when the Hacienda first closes at the end of 1990. And that marked, it didn't mark the end of the Hacienda, but it marked the end of that culture and the end of the significance of the rave revolution. So you get into the new decade, you get into 1991, and there's a void, there's a vacuum in Manchester music. We waited and waited for the second coming. Happy Mondays imploded. They went off to the Caribbean to record an album, came back, it was a bit of a mess. The factory went bankrupt in 1992.
Once the property crash hit and the first sort of credit crunch, which was in 96, 95, took the factory down, everything started to shrink in, and the people stopped coming to the Hacienda. You know, it became a very bad period for clubs, and ours was so big that, you know, any slight change in numbers, it wasn't like a ripple, it was like a tsunami, you know. So you were on a very precarious edge. I mean, you had five fantastic years from 88 to 93, but that wasn't enough to get over the debts that you acquired in 82 to 87. The last 3 years from 93 to 96 were very gloomy, and Rob was in a terrible position because of the live guarantees that he'd signed with the other members of the band, which were still functional, even though the other members of the band weren't in, you know, having anything to do with the club. They still had guarantees out, so Rob was desperate to try and protect them because he was managing them as the group. You know, he was in a terrible position, to be honest. So we had to work really hard, and we did. We tried really hard to keep it open, and it was making headway until the property crash. And once Factory became a victim of the property crash through buying Charles Street, which is ironic, they couldn't pay you. And once they went, it was only a matter of time before the Hacienda went.
The hangover finally arrived. Recession and huge debts forced the club to close in 1997. The Hacienda was demolished in 2002 to make way for more inner-city accommodation. The world's most famous nightclub was no more. But what it and Factory achieved in its short history is immeasurable. They changed the musical landscape and redefined nightclubbing. It was one heck of a party.
Well, I mean, there aren't many groups, let's face it, of people that decide to entertain a whole town for 16 years. Well, let's entertain everybody for 16 years, at our own cost, more or less. Yeah, it was absolutely fantastically generous. And Rob's view was that, well, we're selling loads of records, so let's, you know... And it was about making the place that you lived in richer. I love the club, yeah. But I mean, you know, as my accountant said to me, he said to me one day, he said, "Okay, why are you doing this? Is it for your ego or your wallet?" And I was going, "Well, it must be my ego, because it's certainly not my wallet, because I can safely say without fear of contradiction that none of us got any money out of that bloody club in 16 years.
Well, I mean, Factory had a wonderful
16 years.
From 79 through to 92, we had a wonderful time, it was great. And all these cultures, things come and go. There's no point trying to keep them going. It's like it had its time. As someone who doesn't like the fact that the circus isn't there anymore as an historic site, I should probably have defended the Hacienda more, but at the time it seemed cooler to say, nah, pull it down. It was originally a steel stockholding building,
right,
whose only use after that was either as a yacht showroom, which it was, or as a place for New Order and Factory Records to throw all their money down a large hole.
Tony loved chaos. He loved it. He was changing the world in the same way that Malcolm McLaren. Yeah, he succeeded hugely. I mean, the thing is the heritage that Factory, Joy Division, New Order and the Hacienda has, you couldn't buy that for how many millions? The way that the Hacienda changed the world of music and clubbing, and England in particular, and Manchester especially, it was worth every penny. The thing is about the Hacienda is that it may have caused us problems, you know, and it may have stopped us seeing eye to eye before and after. But the thing was is that the effect it has on people's lives in Manchester, people grew up there, they met their wives there, the kids now go to Hacienda nights, you know, because the dad told them it's a great night, you know, and things like that. And you underestimate the effect that the Hacienda had on the people of Manchester.
I'm Pete Mitchell, and this has been the story of the world's greatest nightclub, Fact 51, the Hacienda Manchester. All that remains are a few final words from the man who was responsible for the whole shenanigans. Please be upstanding for the late, great Anthony H. Wilson.
How old does it feel to treat me like you do when you laid your hands upon me and told me who you are?
Where do I say I was responsible for any of that? Where have I ever said it? I know I get accused of saying it. Where have I ever said I'm responsible for any of it? No, I take blame all the way through for everything. People's deaths, putting the Hacienda stage in the wrong place, building a metal detector door.
Never worked properly.
Because we had a metal floor.
Yeah.
So anyway, no, I get the blame for that, but as in the idea of me taking the responsibility, being responsible. I've never, you know me, we've grown up together. Have I ever said, I created Acid House, Gretton wanted to build a bloody club and we tried to stop him. I can't write songs, can't design sleeves, but my role... You could say I was a Diaghilev figure. He was a Russian impresario, but let's refer as... I would rather think I was Graham Nash. And then again, if you don't know who Graham Nash is, it's okay, but you should probably read more. Graham Nash was, of course, in the Hollies, and later, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, and they always set up that Nash's role with these geniuses, Stills, Young and Crosby, that it was his Salford enthusiasm that glued them together. So maybe I'm a little Graham Nash of the 80s, my enthusiasm gluing all these folks together.
I see a ship in the harbor. I can and shall obey. But if it wasn't for your misfortune, I'd be a heavenly person today. And I thought I was mistaken. And I thought I heard you speak. Tell me, how do I feel? Now I stand here waiting.
This Day in Music, documentaries. An in-depth look at some of the most important musicians in the history of music. This Day in Music, documentaries.